Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
First, a deeper look at the Americans who have gone to Syria to join Islamist militants there. News broke yesterday that an American man was killed in Syria while fighting alongside extremists, most likely the Islamic State or ISIS. U.S. investigators reportedly knew that Douglas MacArthur McCain, who was originally from Minnesota, was in Syria, but they're still trying to figure out how long he was there and the circumstances of his death. FBI Director James Comey has said about 100 Americans have left the country to fight in the Syrian conflict. For more, let's bring in Daniel Byman, a professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. And Dan, how have U.S. officials determined that about 100 Americans are fighting in Syria?
This is an estimate based on a variety of information. Some comes from tips within the community, but a lot comes from the fighters themselves. This is a very socially mediated conflict. We see these guys on Facebook, we see them on Twitter, and they're often not hiding. They're providing a lot of information about where they are and what they're doing.
And can it be difficult for American officials to determine who's fighting for whom? Because there's not just ISIS, there's the Free Syrian Army, there are other splinter groups.
There's a lot of confusion on the various groups, but often the fighters themselves provide the information. They'll say where they are, they'll say who they're with. And this doesn't solve every identification problem. There still is some confusion, but it does help clarify a lot.
Why are some fighters so free to share this kind of information, knowing that it will probably be seen by American officials?
They regard themselves as heroes. They want esteem and credibility back home, and they feel they're going to fight the good fight, whether it's opposing the Assad regime, whether it's opposing the Shia, whom they see as apostates. And they want everyone to know what they're doing. So some, of course, recognize the risks of this, but many of them see themselves as heroes and want to be treated as such.
Dan, in terms of who is going to fight in Syria, is there a particular demographic, any certain profile?
There's no single profile. We are talking, of course, of young Muslim males, but beyond that, you get a wide mix. As we've seen, have a criminal record, but some are quite the opposite. They're people who are going because they believe they're helping their community. So unfortunately, you can't focus too much on any particular characteristic in the background.
And of course, there are Americans going to places other than Syria to fight. We know there have been Americans in Afghanistan and Iraq and Somalia. Is there anything different about the fighting in Syria in terms of why it's attracting people and how many people it's attracting?
Syria is different, I think, in two big ways. One is simply the scale. The Syria conflict has excited Americans, and I'll say Western Muslims in general, more than any similar conflict in the past. In fact, we've seen more volunteers from Europe and the United States than Iraq, Somalia, Afghanistan, all of those combined. The other, and related, is the ease of transit. It's relatively easy to get to Syria. You simply hop on a flight to Europe and from there go into Turkey and cross the border. Getting to Afghanistan or Somalia was far harder, and as a result, not nearly as many people could go.
Once someone does cross the border and get themselves into Syria, how easy is it for them to join a fighting group and get directions?
It's relatively easy to join one of these groups. There's a lot of information available online. Many of the current fighters have their Twitter accounts and Facebook pages, and you can simply go to parts of Turkey where these various groups are recruiting. So if you show up, a spotter is likely to be there to look for you.
Dan, we're hearing reports that, at least initially, ISIS was actively recruiting Western fighters. But now, with the conflict and the ISIS group so much in the news, that recruiting isn't as necessary. So are you seeing more and more people seeking them out versus be recruited?
Unfortunately, the success ISIS has had in Syria, and especially starting in June in Iraq, has made it much more of a household name. And with this publicity has come a boon in recruitment. A lot of people think it's a winner, and as a result, they're joining ISIS without ISIS having to do the same extensive propaganda it's done in the past.
What happens after an American or anyone else who goes overseas to fight finishes fighting? Do you see people coming home? Do they typically stay in the country or stay overseas?
There's a mix of outcomes. Some, of course, die, as we've seen by the most recent news.
Sure.
Some stay there to fight, whether in Syria and Iraq, or even become professional fighters and go from conflict to conflict. But many come back and really have no intention of doing an attack back at home. They've been traumatized by the fighting, or simply they never had an intention of striking where they live. The concern is the relatively few people who come back not only hardened by conflict, but also further radicalized. And the good news is that by being in Syria, they've often brought themselves to the attention of American and allied security services. But it only takes a few people to cause a lot of damage, and that's the concern that American and Western security officials have.
Daniel Byman is a professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
We have an update now on a story we've been following for 2 years. We first met 34-year-old Marine vet Matt Victoriano in Charlotte at the 2012 Democratic Convention. He was networking with other vets who wanted to start small businesses. And after a few starts and stops, Matt did open Intrepid Life Coffee and Spirits in Durham, North Carolina, 7 months ago. We went. Great place. But today, as Matt is being recognized at the White House for being a champion of change, that's a military veteran who's a leader in entrepreneurship, he might have to close the cafe because he's discovered, as many entrepreneurs before him have, it's hard to stay afloat. He's behind on the rent and hoping an Indiegogo fundraising effort will keep it open. We'll get to that. But first, Matt Victoriano in Washington, D.C., in town for the honor. Matt, we're betting you have mixed emotions. We want to congratulate you, but how do you feel about this award?
I got awards in the Marine Corps, and it's like that. You know, you focus on your day-to-day activities and thank those who recognize you, but you move on.
Well, I hope you can enjoy it a little more than that, but I hear in your voice what you've been going through. What happened here? We visited a terrific place, a big space, a gathering space, as well as great coffee. In a kind of high-priced part of renovated Durham, North Carolina, what happened?
The reality is that I started basically underwater without enough money to be able to do the necessary fine-tuning of the shop as well as operate it as the owner-manager. So I spent, from day one, pretty much all of my time trying to keep my head out of the water. Mm-hmm. It was growing during the spring. I didn't know that the letting out of school in the summertime with Duke and UNC was going to have an effect that it did. And it was a slow summer for all the businesses. I talked with the CEO of the Durham Chamber, and she said that it was tough on all the local businesses. And so as opposed to building and building and building like it was in the spring, it hit a stagnant period during the summer.
Well, I can hear the sound of heads nodding all across America because this is the story of an entrepreneur. You know, not enough capital maybe in the beginning, learning hard lessons along the way, maybe get someone to do the grunt work so you can do more of the overseeing, things like that. And then being prepared for pitfalls like, oh, where'd all the students go? I'm sure you've talked to other entrepreneurs who say, yeah, this is part of our lives, just learning as we go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so how's the Indiegogo going?
It's going better than I could expect. I did that because I had an outcry from the local community and some prominent business owners who, even the owners of a local coffee shop that were extremely supportive and liked the mission and what I had to offer. They basically bent my arm and said, you will do this crowdfunding or we will find you where you live and hunt you down.
By the way, we've been hearing from people, you know, people from your area writing us and saying, lawmakers, state senator there writing us and saying, have you heard what's happening here? We have to do something. So people want to help. But do you, as a, you know, you have a big heart and you had this mission of wanting to have a gathering place for veterans and be able to hire them. But is the entrepreneur side of your head saying, hey, you got to quit when you're ahead and maybe start somewhere else?
I've never had that mentality. and it hasn't led me wrong before. If you looked at me before I joined the Marines, I was a scrawny little kid that, you know, people were like, are you sure you want to do the Marines? That's the hard branch. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to do it. And I haven't quit. And I don't plan on quitting. I don't view things as I'm going to quit while I'm ahead. I'd rather go out in flames than walk out the door.
Yeah. Well, so you're sticking with the September 5th deadline. Now, you know, the owner of the building says they are, you know, looking to bring someone else in after the 7th. So you got this little window here. And we know we'll link people to the site. We know that the donations will be to help pay that rent, but also hire a shop manager, focus on event planning, some great things. You want to do things like game nights, trivia, storytelling, things that have helped other coffee shops go beyond just the coffee. But what about that mission? Were you able to hire as many veterans as you wanted?
Yeah, I was. I've been able to work with about 4 combat veterans at this point. That's a separate job in itself, because I see in them the struggles that I have faced myself in. Pretty much with all of them, they would have gotten fired a long time ago with a civilian employee or employer. But it's worth toughing it out, and it's extremely tough on me to have to deal with a lot of the issues that they deal with. But on the flip side, they can be some extremely hardworking and dependable individuals that, you know, I could place with a lot of responsibility.
Well, that extra effort of almost being counselor and support group for your employees, and you know, we saw some of that in action when we were there. That's what's won you this award. What would you want policymakers in Washington to hear? What would you want to say if you could when you're at the White House?
Well, I think it's important to note out that every time I have a conversation with somebody, they go, well, what kind of veteran small business loan did you get? And the reality is that there aren't any. They need to invest more time and resources into providing the monetary assistance for veterans to start small businesses and put a little bit more time and effort into the training. I really don't think that you should be fighting another veteran for a slot to receive training. So that's something that I would really like to focus on.
Well, I hope you reach some ears there. That's Matt Victoriano, a Marine vet, being honored at the White House today, a champion of change, which means that he has served as a leader in entrepreneurship, serving his country through his business and helping other vets as well. But as we said, a parallel story is his coffee shop is teetering. So we'll link people who might want to help out to his Indiegogo fundraising effort. Matt, you know, we are always fascinated by whatever your next chapter is, and we can't wait to hear it. Thanks so much.
Good to talk with you again. Thanks a lot.
Oh, and by the way, Matt wanted us to say that Indiegogo, which is like Kickstarter, is not a charity. If you contribute, you will get coffee. A caution, our next story is a disturbing one. It involves child sexual abuse, but the alleged victims may get their day in court. This week, the Vatican announced that a defrocked archbishop already facing criminal charges under Vatican law for allegedly paying underage boys for sexual acts has lost his diplomatic immunity and could now possibly be tried outside the Holy See. That stunning reversal came after an explosive article in the New York Times detailed claims that Archbishop Joseph Wesolowski, the now former Vatican ambassador to the Dominican Republic, sexually abused young boys and then was spirited out of the country by Vatican officials who didn't inform local authorities of the evidence against him. Vatican officials then invoked diplomatic immunity to help Wesolowski avoid prosecution. There's a lot at stake here. If he's tried in the Vatican, it will be the first criminal trial there for child sexual abuse. If he's tried back in the Dominican Republic or elsewhere, he'll be the highest Vatican official to be put on trial for sex abuse ever. Lori Goodstein is the national religion correspondent for the New York Times. She joins us from New York. And Lori, your thoughts on the announcement from the Vatican, likely in response to your devastating report?
Well, they responded very quickly to the article. We had asked them questions in the past about whether they would allow the former ambassador to be extradited to either the Dominican Republic or to the country that he's from, Poland, which has also been trying to extradite him. And this was the first confirmation we got that they would be willing to do that.
Yeah. Well, so take us back. You traveled to the Dominican Republic, talked to many people there. This, as we said, is the first time a top Vatican ambassador has been accused of child sex abuse. How and when did this first come to the Vatican's attention?
Last year, a friend of the ambassador was arrested, a deacon who was walking along the waterfront promenade in front of a lot of hotels in the capital, Santo Domingo, and he was looking for young men for sexual acts. Well, this friend, this deacon, was arrested. And from prison, the deacon sent a letter to the church officials in the Dominican Republic and also to the ambassador, really confessing that he had been picking up young men for sex, not for himself, but for the ambassador. And this is how the Vatican found out that their ambassador was engaged in this, or at least first learned of the allegations. And very soon, the ambassador was removed from the country.
And peel this back even more. The ambassador would have had to enlist the help of the deacon because a reporter in the country had gotten on to what he was doing.
Right. The reason a reporter got onto it is that the ambassador was a constant presence on the waterfront. He would stroll along. He lived there for 5 years, and he was there, by some accounts, almost every day, having a beer in a waterfront cafe and then strolling along. And people who worked and lived in the waterfront neighborhood noticed that he was going off with young boys. And eventually, somebody identified him because the Vatican ambassador was, after all, in the news. His face was publicly known. He celebrated Mass. And so somebody identified, hey, this is the Vatican ambassador, and they alerted a local television reporter who sent out a crew to tail him.
And the archbishop, the ambassador, Wasilowski, noticed that he was being tailed. He actually confronted the reporter. He soon disappeared from the waterfront, and the deacon appears. Nobody comes to bail out this deacon who's sitting in jail. It snowballs from there. Suddenly, Wasilowski is spirited out of the country. What did Dominican officials say about that?
Well, they said they were shocked because the first they even learned of the allegations was from the TV report. The TV reporter did end up interviewing a young man who said he had been sexually abused by the ambassador and running a report on television. That's the first time that the district attorney or the attorney general in the country even knew there were allegations against this man, and he was already out of the country.
You spoke to children as well. What were some of the things they said? And we want to, you know, we'd be careful of our listening audience, maybe children in it, but what did they allege that the ambassador asked them to do?
Well, I'd like to tell you a little bit about these children. These are really poor, poor children who make a living for themselves and for their families by shining shoes along the waterfront. And on a good day, they might earn something like $1.50. Well, this man came along and said, here's $25 or more, even as much as $100, if you'll come with me and perform a sexual act. And talking with these kids, they were very ashamed. Some of them initially didn't want to reveal what had happened, but they were also angry because later when they found out who the man was, why perhaps he was there all the time, why he had so much money, they just couldn't wrap their heads around this kind of hypocrisy. They're all people who go to church, and they couldn't make sense of it.
Well, and we should say these are allegations. But it became pretty clear that there was something of a cover-up. He spirited out of the country. People reported seeing him strolling around. The Vatican invokes this diplomatic immunity. What does Vatican law say about what they're supposed to do when something like this happens?
The guidelines that the Vatican has say that in countries where reporting is mandatory, church officials are supposed to report allegations, and that's what they didn't do in this case. But the Vatican also has a leg to stand on in saying that he has diplomatic immunity. Now, they had a choice. They could have waived diplomatic immunity, but they didn't. And now this week, the Vatican is saying, well, he's no longer a diplomat. He no longer has diplomatic immunity. So they're saying that now, but it is only after the article came out. They certainly could have said that months ago.
Well, look, you mentioned Poland. There's also been shockwaves through Poland because that's where Wasilowski was ordained by the Polish prelate who went on to become Pope John Paul II. And now you have Pope Francis who has said he's going to do something about clergy sex abuse. What do you think happens now? Do you think the Vatican will allow him to be sent to the Dominican Republic to be tried?
I think the announcement this week indicates that they will. And I have no doubt that in the end that there will be justice done. First, the Vatican will hold its own criminal trial, which is very, very unusual. But they seem to be indicating that they're not going to shield him from being tried in another country as well.
And you mentioned that these kids are Catholic. The country is Catholic, the Dominican Republic. How has this affected faith?
Well, the scandal of sexual abuse has not been heard about much in the Dominican Republic. And so this was a very, very shocking episode. It also happened at the same time as another Polish priest was accused of sexual abuse, and he fled the country. And that's why the government of Poland is looking into this and looking also into the relationship and connections between that Polish priest and the ambassador, also Polish. So two very visible cases happening at the same time. And talking with Catholics in the Dominican Republic who told me that it did affect their faith. But their faith can also be restored. And I think everybody's watching to see what happens.
A Catholic priest told you people are now saying no child of mine is going to go to a Catholic church. That's pretty stunning from the Dominican Republic. Lori Goodstein, national religion correspondent for The New York Times. We'll link you to her reporting at hereandnow.org. Lori, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Is Snapchat really worth $10 billion? A lot of people are wondering that today after a Silicon Valley venture capital firm reportedly valued the popular social media service at that number. But Snapchat, a mobile app known for its disappearing messages, still hasn't come up with a reliable way to make money. Derek Thompson of The Atlantic joins us now to talk about this. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
And Derek, Snapchat was, of course, created by two Stanford students in 2011. It's hugely popular with teenagers. But why do you think that Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers, a pretty fabled venture capital firm, sees in this company?
Some listeners might not know what Snapchat quite is or why we're talking about it, so I just want to spend a little bit of time there.
Sure.
It is a bit like sending your friend a photo or a video over text, except that here the message disappears after a certain number of seconds. And if that's sort of confusing to you, then think about TV. When you watch TV, you don't typically stop and rewind it. It passes before your eyes, and then it's gone. So if you can imagine a service with the use case of text and the transience of television, you have sort of a good idea of what Snapchat is and why. It's popular. So now we want to think about, okay, why is this thing popular? How popular is it? If you ask high school and college students about their favorite daily apps, the list goes like this. At number one, Facebook. Two, Instagram, which is owned by Facebook. And three, Snapchat. So if you take out Facebook, it is the most popular app among millennials, more than Pandora, more than Twitter. It's even more popular than phone calls. Snapchat is more popular than the phone function of phones. So it is absolutely an essential tool in young people's communications arsenal, and that's why you have so much interest in it.
Now, it's a free app, yet the company has virtually no revenue. What's the potential revenue in its business model?
There is a plan to roll out ads. There's something called Snapchat Discovery, which is a platform they're beginning to think about now to allow companies to send their own messages the same way you would receive messages from friends. And again, here, I would encourage people to think of this a bit like television. Right now, Snapchat plays photos and videos from friends. This is like programming. And around programming, TV networks sell ads. So you can imagine promotions from restaurants and clothing companies, whatnot, showing up on your phone in this queue that you could click on and then potentially find deals for products and brands that you already like or products and brands that you want to discover and learn more about. So I imagine that they're probably going to try to seed advertisements in between messages that you're seeing from your friends.
The TV analogy is a good one, I think. I think that does make it very understandable. Now, according to the Wall Street Journal, Snapchat has about 100 million users each month, a big number, no doubt. But how does that compare to other messaging apps?
So Snapchat has 100 million users and its valuation is $10 billion. Twitter has about three times as many users, about 300 million monthly active uniques. And its valuation is three times as much as Snapchat's as well, at $30 billion. So you have a very similar valuation per monthly active to do the little bit of math. The weird thing about this, some people are saying, is that Twitter has a established and growing ad platform. They are selling ads in a way that Snapchat is currently not. So some people are saying, we have no idea yet if people are going to click on these ads that Snapchat uses. You know, I use the comparison to television, but we know that TV ads work, or that at least that marketers are willing to buy them. We don't yet know if that ad experience is going to work for Snapchat. So people, are a little astonished that it's this high, particularly since Facebook offered $3 billion, not $10 billion for them just a few months ago.
And Snapchat rejected that bid.
And they rejected this bid. And now it seems utterly brilliant for them to have rejected the bid, and now that they're valued at three times more. I do think that what you're seeing right now is just the value of communication scale. When you have scale, the theory is that you will have an advertisement platform to follow it.
Derek Thompson of The Atlantic, thanks very much.
So why is this ceasefire different from all others? That's the question today as the peace between Hamas and Israel hold. One answer to that question is it's not a several-day ceasefire. It's a truce. It's open-ended. Reached by a deal that's a little ambiguous. Israel will keep its restrictions over Gaza, though they'll be eased somewhat, including for humanitarian aid materials. But that peace comes as outside militants, including some connected to al-Qaeda, took over a Syrian checkpoint on the neighboring Golan Heights. Well, to connect the dots in the region, we found Aaron David Miller of the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., up in Maine. He served as a top Middle East negotiator for both Republican and Democratic administrations. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us. And your take on this truce, is this the real deal?
If you mean by the real deal that this is going to stop the ongoing 50-day confrontation between Israel and Hamas for now and could buy a substantial interval of calm and quiet, I think the answer is yes. The odds, and I'm being cautious here, favor traction for this ceasefire unlike all the others. And the reasons, I think, are very clear. Both sides are exhausted, both politically and from a military point of view. And I think both reach the conclusion that they risk with their respective publics quite a bit of political capital if the war continued without seemingly being able to change any of the fundamental objectives. So odds are you've got more traction on this one, and it will probably hold.
Well, but the start with the Israeli side, we understand that Prime Minister Netanyahu didn't even put it to a vote because he knew there would be so many in his own country who would object to a truce.
Right. On the Israeli side, it doesn't mean that either side is out of political trouble. The prime minister, who inherently is risk averse and knows the downsides of a war in which produces a tie, I think understood that there was enough gained operationally from this basically to move toward a new phase. But we should be under no illusion, either on the Israeli or the Hamas side, that this solves the strategic problem that separates either Israel and Hamas or the other dimension of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Israel and the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas. The truce, if that's what it is, has accomplished neither of those objectives.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that the deal did not address. It's put off some really difficult questions. Israel is demanding demilitarization. They do not get that in the deal. Hamas is demanding a seaport and an airport to stop this sort of, what they call an imprisoning of Gazans. And this is echoes of the same stalemate in the overall two-state talks. There are intractable issues on both sides.
I think you're 100% right, Robin. And unlike the previous two rounds, 08-09 on one hand and 2012, where expectations were a tad more realistic at the beginning of this crisis, this latest round, both Hamas was desperate, financially bankrupt, politically isolated, basically went for broke on the assumption that somehow their high-trajectory rockets would essentially force the Israelis into making major concessions to open up Gaza and release prisoners. On the other hand, the Israelis went into this crisis determined not to produce a tie, as the other rounds have been, and touting this notion of demilitarization, which frankly was always a bridge too far. And part of the reason it dragged on for 50 days was that there was a gap between what Hamas's military leadership promised 1.8 million Gazans and what Benjamin Netanyahu promised his own constituency. And that gap, frankly, has not been closed and will not be closed.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. We looked at dissent on the Israeli side. On the Gazan side, first of all, were people surprised that Gaza could hold on and had this much military capability for so long? And within Gaza, Hamas is claiming victory, but how are Gazans seeing it? Is Hamas weakened or strengthened?
I think operationally, from a military point of view, I think there's no doubt that Hamas has been weakened. On the front side, their tunnels have been closed, at least those with entries into Israel proper. The 10,000 estimated high-trajectory weapons, perhaps two-thirds, have been destroyed. Politically, Hamas now has a huge challenge of trying to explain and justify what these last 50 days were all about. The deal on the table, frankly, could have been had 3 weeks ago. In terms of the civilian population, it's obviously, in this kind of situation, impossible to say. I think the celebratory gunfire and the cheering and the shouting you heard yesterday is very much driven not by the fact that Gazans believe they've somehow bested the Israelis, But there's a collective, has to be, a collective sigh of relief that maybe now, with some limited economic openings, Gaza can be put on the road to recovery, although by some estimates it could take a decade.
Well, meanwhile, there are talks in Cairo about Gaza-Israel relations. Two-state talks somewhere in there about the Palestinian Authority and Israel. Palestinian Authority, of course, in the West Bank under Abbas. And a lot going on in the region. We just want to ask you very briefly, Aaron David Miller. You have Egypt and the UAE bombing militants in Libya. You have the U.S. seriously considering bombing ISIS in neighboring Syria. And Syrian rebels taking over a border post on the Golan Heights. Just very briefly, how much does everything else that's going on in the region impact what happens going forward between Israel and Palestinians?
Terrific question. Never in my years have I seen a more direct correlation between regional developments and what happens on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. There was a time where, in fact, you could separate the two. And willful and heroic Israelis and Palestinians and Arabs and Israelis could somehow hermetically seal their process against these regional forces. Not now. And Gaza is an example of that. Stunning silence, Robin, on the part of the UAE, Egypt, and much of the Arab world in the face of colossal death and destruction in Gaza. Never would I have imagined a time that the Arabs would be so quiescent. And the reasons they are is that they fear the rise of Sunni jihadism, of which they consider Hamas a part, more than they worry and fear the Israelis. And this tells you that their priorities are regional. On one hand, Iran, on the other, Sunni jihadis and ISIS. And so there is no longer the capacity to hermetically seal the Israeli-Palestinian issue, if you ever could fully, from these regional winds, which right now are blowing very cold.
Aaron David Miller of the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., also served as a top Middle East negotiator for both Republican and Democratic administrations. And by the way, we want to mention you have a new book coming out soon, The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. We'll leave you with that provocative title and talk to you about that in the fall. But thanks so much, Aaron.
Thank you, Robin.
One of the great dreams of the medical research world is to help paralyzed people unable to use their legs be able to walk again. Implanting electrode stimulators into injured spinal cords has shown some promise. Stem cell spinal cord regeneration has been elusive so far. But one high-tech company is taking a completely different approach. ReWalk Robotics has built a motorized exoskeleton that gives some people with debilitating spinal injuries the ability to walk, and it's the first such device to receive FDA approval.
I'm strapping, starting from the lower limbs and working my way up.
ReWalk Robotics has built a motorized exoskeleton that gives some people with debilitating spinal injuries the ability to walk, and it's the first such device to receive FDA approval.
Now I'm going to put in, sit to stand, which is that mode right there. It's going to beat once a little, like get on your mark. Just get set.
That's Gene Loriano being thrust upright by the motors strapped to his legs. He's a 51-year-old Army veteran who's been in a wheelchair ever since he fell during a welding job in Manhattan in 2001.
I felt the ladder go from under me. I remember hitting the ladder. I remember after that, because it's a blank spot there, and then I remember trying to get up and looking at like this, the way I'm trying to get up, it didn't seem right. And passing out again. Next time I woke, I was in the hospital with pumping my stomach.
We met Loriano recently during a visit to ReWalk's Marlboro, Massachusetts office. It's the U.S. headquarters of its Israeli parent company, Argo Medical Technologies. Loriano says when he wears the suit in public, he gets called all sorts of nicknames by amazed onlookers, from RoboCop to Iron Man. But the exoskeleton Loriano wears isn't science fiction. It weighs almost 50 pounds and consists of leg braces, motors, and a backpack containing a rechargeable battery, along with hefty Velcro straps, a wristwatch remote control, and arm crutches for balance. The device is able to thrust Loriano up onto his feet with the push of a button.
Now I'm going to press walk. Now I'm going to walk.
Walk. And with that, he slowly makes his way across the room.
Yeah, I can walk with this thing all day.
That battery backpack also contains the brains of the device, a computer that's able to sense a slight lean forward, and once that's detected, automatically move Loriano's legs. When Loriano stands upright, he's more than 6 feet tall, and he says that in addition to letting him walk, the device gives him something else that might not mean much to you or me. It lets him meet people on their level, literally.
Once I'm in this, I feel like you. You know, I stand up, I talk to people eye to eye. That feeling hits me as soon as I even think about it. Like this morning, I got up early and I know that I'm going to talk to people, whatever my mindset is, I'm going to get to walk.
Loriano was part of the clinical study phase of the ReWalk exoskeleton. He doesn't own a ReWalk, but now that the device has FDA approval, he hopes the Veterans Administration will buy him one.
So when you see it, you think, oh yeah, it's going to be easy. So when you get in it, and it's not that, it's just, I would describe it, I guess, so I'm watching my kids learning how to walk. It's the same thing. You're relearning your balance and all that. And also the stretching is a factor, because when you're sitting for so long, your hips, your tendons get tight. So when I first got up, it felt like if I was tied to two horses and they're stretching me, you feel that stretch.
And I bet you had lost a lot of muscle over a decade of not moving much.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because before I started using this, and I would sit up on a chair on my bed, I would hold on. A good 8 months into it, I find myself that I can just sit up now.
That's one of the limitations of the ReWalk device. It only works for paraplegics with some types of spinal cord injuries, and it doesn't work at all for quadriplegics. It also requires a certain level of physical fitness, a level that can be hard to meet for someone who's been in a wheelchair for many years. The biggest hurdle may be that the ReWalk exoskeleton costs about $70,000, and it's rarely covered by insurance.
It's expensive in one sense, but I think this is actually a cost saver to the medical society and medical system.
That's Larry Jasinski, the CEO of ReWalk Robotics.
We reduce the amount of cost for medications. We reduce the cost of many complications that have to be treated.
Things like skin deteriorating, all the sort of the ways the body can decline when you're paralyzed.
I'll give you an example. A pressure ulcer to be treated in an American hospital, the average cost is $79,000. This device, which lasts for 5 years, is $69,500. Between medications and avoided medical complications that require hospitalization, this will probably reduce the money that insurance companies or individuals have to spend.
Jasinski says reports from ReWalk users have been heartwarming.
The first user in the United States, when she put her suit on in her home for the first time, stood up and looked out her kitchen window for the first time in years with tears running down her face. The funny part was, in that same kitchen, after she looked out the window, she's walking and looking in the cabinets, and she has a partner that lives with her. She found a secret stash of candy hidden up in the cabinet that she couldn't see for the last number of years.
The next step for ReWalk is to try to get its device into the hands of more users. That means pushing for more insurance coverage. The FDA just gave ReWalk the green light in June, and so far, only a handful of insurance companies are on board. Jasinski also says ReWalk hopes to develop a device that would work for people with quadriplegia.
We do have a effort for a quadriplegic product, and we hope to get to show that to you in the next year or two.
And in terms of the potential reach, there are, is it 200,000 people in the U.S. that have some kind of spinal cord injury?
A little more. It's about 273,000 today.
And many, many more in wheelchairs for a variety of reasons.
Yes. You can really almost go up to about 2 million in wheelchairs for some reason or another. One of the future dreams of this technology for all of us that are beginning to, in the space, the idea of using a wearable robot to help with an injury, to help with an illness, to help with other things that have limited you in life, I think you're going to see over the next decade, these are going to almost become common.
Both Jasinski and Loriano compare the potential of ReWalk to cell phones, which have become much smaller and more powerful as they've evolved. They hope the motorized exoskeleton will evolve in the same way.
I think we're going to make it more portable, and because right now it's wonderful for them to use it around the community and at home. But if they want to go on vacation, it's not so hard for the user because they can use it anywhere in the world. But to get it on an airplane, we'd like to make it a little more compact. We've had them ask for other things that we probably can't do, but sometimes they want to speed it up. We've had one ask if they could dance in it. That's a little harder on the software side.
Currently, the ReWalk device can move at about 3 miles an hour, just a bit slower than your average sidewalk stroll. If the VA comes through and Gene Laureano gets a Rewalk exoskeleton of his own, he says he has a lot of plans.
Believe me, the day that I get mines, I have so many errands to make. If I don't have errands that day, errands will pop up.
What's your dream first day if you had one of these? What would you do when you got up in the morning?
So many. Go to church.
Really?
Yeah. Go to church. Another thing I have, I've never mentioned this to anybody, but I have a 28-year-old daughter. And I know someday she'll get married. I would like to have one to walk her down the aisle instead of opposed to rolling behind her.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be cool too.
You know, Robin, obviously limitations, it's expensive, you know, it doesn't work for quadriplegics right now, but really huge potential. It's an amazing device, it seems like.
Just even for a wedding.
Absolutely. To see pictures of the Rewalk device, go to hearandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.